nobody.
Excuse me.
My name is Xabache. He who talks loud, say nothing.
He who talks loud. I thought you said your name was Nobody. Ancient tradition that the world will be consumed in fire at the end of 6,000 years is true, as I've heard from hell. The whole creation will be consumed and appear infinite and holy, whereas it now appears finite and corrupt. This will come to pass by an improvement of sensual enjoyment. But the first notion that man has a body distinct from his soul is to be expunged. This I shall do by printing in the infernal method, by corrosives, which in hell are salutary and medicinal, melting apparent surfaces away and displaying the infinite which is hid. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite, for man has closed himself up. Till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern.
That was the Dead Man soundtrack, and that track was Do You Know How to Use This Weapon?
Featuring Johnny Depp.
Johnny
and
Depp.
And
yep.
Neil Young.
Yep.
Excellent. Reading from Blake's Marriage of Heaven and Hell. Yeah, well, the goal we're going for, we'll get to some other romantic poets, maybe. It's either Keats writing to Shelley or Shelley writing to Keats, advising the other poet to, is it, sew every rift with gold or something like that? So maybe that's the goal, the poetic goal we're going for. But I'm Steve Collis. Here with Roger Farr, and our guests tonight are Cecily Nicholson and Nava Smolesh. Welcome, Cecily and Nava.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to get you both to read first, and then we'll have some discussion after a bit. So welcome to Short Range Poetic Device.
You better.
Now, come on, better. Somebody read.
We have ways of making it talk.
Okay, how did that happen? All right. I'm going to begin with an inspirational quote from Bud Mercer. Our road systems are obviously critical to everything we do, he said. If you block a major artery that commerce, industry, business, and the opening ceremonies require, you know the tolerance of the police is likely to change. For perfect protection. This is the unit responsible for the unit that will get us through 2010 strictly from an enforcement perspective. Preparatory exercise, the command, crime fighters, farewell, significant, uniformed presence, personnel, effect, arrests. Army accustomed to that very mixture. Army their asses. Predatory security goes deep, navigational crew in the event of, despite the magnitude of the file proceeding nicely sealed. good liaisoning with those people, their organizations feel that appropriate political and commercial expression is to be expectorates, flu, resort, district, relax, put your feet up on commensurate rights to protect you, our partners dictate, amateur swastikas telling the O story, attentive to fat brand culture, clean as commercial monitor, fast access and action, local, be filter for Canada is market, branding tramples snow. Some archive surface, gloss, growth, chemical barb, sickening, Trump. If they give up making money, it will demand payments. Musical billions, these spirited staples sharp through actual paper. Outburst soul, strategic importance of making. We must make. Special requests. Special requests will not be granted. Must be taken. From cordon traffic dividers. Teal-coated fuzzy drivers. Lanes, reserve arteries, and feudal O. Contre la muerte. Why? Eh? Mi hoser inarticulacy. These days, these are the days of miracle and wonder. Gather, counter, attach here un bout d'horizon on the field of demonstration. Sporty, always be closing. Sing. This one is called North Slope. Purchase gateway, road industry, wells, port, trestles bowed to fuel, precede housing facilities. Rare gull sighting on shore, North Slope system. Fell awake to the neighbor crouched by the bed, side table seeps, waterway swabs, DNA for the record. Split glass when water, the lamp got knocked over. Diamond strict, seismic, pipeline flow, PCB room, metal heavy, soft room, interview since an alarm had been sounded. As arsenic cash startled sentinels heed climate, most like body, unicorn public, talk, news, evening, post, farmers, harrow, muscle, garrison, compromise, shoulder to the wall, certain escape, but we cannot speak. Spurs, protrude, yellow cube, try to imagine the ringing we, hands up, acknowledge, hooking fingers, austerity, winged ecology, poly, a field, a wide cage, surrounded by experts, taught surveys, movement gravely othered, graves, goods, porters, face front army, dysphoric reserves, hand sanitizer, what to eat at the library, un peu de discipline, et montre très bon, mine, move, grateful memory. Departments, defenders, all over country, our game plan, our operational plan, adopted as their own, wing, rip, trust, no ones or twos, even gentle, all averred, one to darn down, atmosphere, we hear, wistful signals, a long coastline. Let's see, how about two more? Okay. So this one is inspired from standing on the shore, or sort of the edge of one of the largest open pit copper mines in North America, and just some of the despair and trying to process there.
Where's that mine?
In small town, company town called Bagdad, Arizona. A lot of the language in this comes directly from signage that's posted for the workers. Copper mine. Business endeavors hit, the main thing hit, like a ton per operated hour operating. The main thing to keep the main thing the main thing. Inexpensive, it takes focus, perfect shift. Back to basics is core, not complex work. Down events are not acceptable. Down events are not normal. Down events are the enemy of reliability. We triage capacity to the company, assurance town, uninterrupted stability, measures, sourcing, productivity, engineered analysis, the appropriate, response, guidance, Bright Angel Canyon. All the boats in once, everyone data seemed unwell, everyone appeared to be dying, still didn't believe in changeable rock progression. Sometimes it's fallen work orders following warrants, hope you're walking, chalk cursive arteries, facile, s'applique, pré-olympique, free clinics, make money, money, everything erodes around while some people got, you can call, keep calling, rain ain't no emergency. People speak poetry, other batten hold up deep, let me tell you, If you've been in my shoes, brother, you know how it is often, too much. Aggressive New Year prices. Invest, earn, enjoy, buy on board, ground private, no property. Stick to own kind, convene containers, trailers. Smaller than circles, swing hammer being born for driven engines once rewarded for their steam. Assembly of currency in the shadow of many things. White knuckling through, I met my first computer. Plan stops to wonder more than schedules or calculating. We have all the pieces, we are not configured to use them. Few stars stationed over the harbor, home, forgot, for fear, dear fancy. Now turning blue, cornflower, understand we. Understand reason, livable terms are liable. Project reporting manual makes payroll. Deduction system reset payments, return clean, fine credit, deduct balance. Excuse me. Bach, individual, with the common touch, regard, sentence, fresh flower vending machine out of change. She wanders night times and during maintenance. Strong, earnest office, there is community. Salary untiring, united only to the vine pinch, between thumb and index, other thrashing about. Las metas de hoy as day workers, packers, steers. Incendiary tank will cause condo development, will cause mass extinction of cellular life, will cause completely safe rotating tomorrows. Real, a special place. Yes, their second-hand billion remote people, retouched priorities, wealth of experience to a slow music dispersal. Vibration, screw, loft, loose, right, taut, authority, restricted airways, somos en solo río, voice, voice. And if there's time, I have one more poem.
There's time.
Okay. This is just collected from a scattering of phrases and things that I overheard hanging out around the fire at Tent City. Things have been protected so that nobody's identity is revealed. So today at Tent City, Alcatraz is an island. Sorry, Alcatraz is not an island. It's an idea. That's Robert Oak's words. We have to take back the land. The Russian media wants to talk to someone. I love Vancouver. I'm going to the Women's Center. We need some reading material. We need some wood. We need bricks. Once we are united, they cannot bend us. They are not going to walk all over us. Does anybody want to speak to the Russian media? Cedar and sweetgrass are at the bottom of the fire. It's for peace. Vanok doesn't like fires. She's been running for 2 years. They went looking for me at my work. You know how to talk. You're needed here. I thought it was cigarettes, but it was a pack of playing cards. Is this the Tent City? This is the right one, eh? There isn't like another one around here? Cheap price, but it's not a cheap chair. I remember the reclamation site at Six Nations. It was barren because they had taken all the trees. I remember trying to set up my tent in that wind. Thanks.
Wow. Wonderful.
Thanks a lot, Cecily. And Nava is going to read next. Slight pause while we breathe a second, eh? That Tent City, it's producing some poetry, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I like it.
I've seen some.
I loved that piece. Thanks for sharing that, Cecily. I can hear a lot of those echoes. Well,
give us what you got.
Well, in the build-ups to the Olympics, this is kind of what I said when I read at the press release event at Rhizome last week ago.
I don't know.
It's been a long week. I've largely, in the build-up, I've just been wordless. I write a lot, and I didn't have any words. I was feeling overwhelmed and pretty isolated, feeling the city getting militarized. Yeah. But there was this event at press release, and, you know, I had to write something, so I was like, I just wrote whatever I had. And it didn't feel all that poetic, but then I read it, and there was a lot of resonance for people that were experiencing similar things. And I think that's part of the power of words, is the sense of, like, a profound connection that we have with each other. It's one of those ways that we root together and ground and build community together. So I'm going to share this in that spirit. It's called O Lyric. We interrupt your regularly scheduled programming to bring you a brand new Vancouver. A city on steroids, cheating its way through the public sphere. Vancouver, the athlete, pumped up on steroids, injects cash and laughs into the system, lies and smiles to race for the finish line. Pumped up PR bullets, pumped and primed, media spokespeople primed for prime time, smear tactics, cameras preened and poets forewarned for appropriateness. The sheen wears thin for those of us living in this city, this brand new Vancouver, this Bankcouver, this branded new Vancouver, cleaned of public will, cleaned of social relationships, cops on cruise ships in the harbor, assistance to shelter. It takes a tent village to raise a voice. After Sumi gets done with dissenters and civil disobedience, and the Canadian military cleans up homeless people from our streets, Vancouver can have its perfect, happy portrait of an empty city. Only Kwachi, alone, alone, left in the empty town square, waving HBC red mittens in the isolated air as canned cheers echo from prepaid loudspeakers and bounce off the empty buildings. Ads yell, "You gotta be here," but all of us are elsewhere, locked up, driven out, shut up, cut up. The happiest city is an empty city. No fuss, no muss, no demands for justice, no land title redress, no wheelchair blockades to embarrass us, just an empty canvas, like this terra nullius, empty land fresh for corporate plunder. So, since we're still here, and this is no empty city, this is no pure, polished spectacle, this is no land of empty property values, but actual land which our actual feet walk. Since we are still here, and apparently we refuse to shut up, I've got some questions. If the Olympics are so great, why does the IOC need to tell me what to think about them? And if the Olympics are so great, why does Vanok need to tell this host city's poet laureate covered in laurels that there are appropriate themes for poetry? And why does the Cultural Olympiad need to sign only happy messages into street musician contracts or tell the carnival band that the only carnival today is capital? And why does the IOC need to tell the poets speaking on streets and the artists trying to eat that the Olympics must mean cheer, or that their voices won't be welcome here, and neither will their bodies, and that happiness can be bought in empty bottles? If the Olympics are wonderful, why am I eating dinner next to more military than I have seen since I went to Israel when I was 19? And if the Olympics are a celebration, why does my city feel so dangerous, hard-edged and starving in the midst of this party? We don't tell the birds, "Fly or I'll beat you." Things that come naturally don't need the threat. So why does Olympic cheer need this enforcement? Bylaws and cameras and cop cars and contracts and copyrights that seek to muzzle honesty. The forced cheer of torch marches, helicopters circling, vultures over spectacle, flesh of the wounded. And if the games are so great, then why am I dry of words, sharpening pencils, poemless in the afternoons, covering my head with blankets, afraid to leave the house? Police don't make me safe. Community makes me safe, and the land being fed feeds us in return. And that's dedicated to Cynthia Oka and to the press release group.
Nice.
Yeah. And then I had a couple pieces. Hi, man. Time.
You're great. Read a couple more pieces.
I had a couple pieces that are a little older, but they came up for me again. At the Tent City, the people have seen the Canadian Border Service Agency Inland Patrol has been circulating, mm-hmm. and you know, for me, that brings up a lot of, you know, they can't do anything to me, but it brings up a lot of fear for me for people that, you know, for whom that CBSA is frightening. And so I got this piece that was, it's actually dedicated to Evie and Miranda, which are the main characters in Larissa Lai's Saltfish Girl. And you guys probably know the book. And one of them, obviously. Yeah, and one of them is raised within this compound, this corporate compound, where that's replaced the nation state. And the other one is in the illegal zone and doesn't have any legal identity because she's not legally human. She's part fish. And she, and this relationship builds up between them. And so seeing it as a metaphor for illegality, obviously. I was inspired a while ago when Lursorlai was right in residence, actually, and we had some conversations. I was inspired to write this poem about the relationships that develop across that dividing line of those by those of us protected by these systems and those who experience the same systems as violence. But that line's actually kind of thin and arbitrary, yeah. Even though it's quite real. So it's called Alloy. It's for Evie and Miranda. You pass in front of me, my body made of mercury, white alloy. Reticent identities now read in retina scan, digits encoded in databanks. Number 9 begins your national rational name, your 9 digits read as sin encode an expiry on your existence. Like a transnational batch of vegetables improperly transported, checkboxed rotten on arrival in port, rolled over, boarded by border police in uniform non-history, there is only this moment. Biometrically encoded aluminum in my bones, radiation sickness, immigration sickness, state of the nation sickness, state of the art technology to read the biometric breathing patterns of lungfish. While illegal underwater we die, drown I in whiteness and she in color. Hesitant, reticent, retinas resonate because none is too many, so save the dogs, send back the migrant girls, but all aboard if you can clean industrial ceramic. The nation needs you, lovelies. Leave home, husband, wife, life for non-existence in a land too... Two-finger touchdown like Kafka's Mr. K. Only this time it is one red middle scanned for security. One resistant thumb held away in flight. Test me, I've bled. Heavy lead traces may grace my veins, but the cancer is in yours. One curable, one not. Both alive at cost. And what do I know? I haven't studied... Just worked it and been worked over by this metal in my teeth, these stories of my specialness, this global monotony, assembly line, lives in television crisp nuclear winter, huddled by the fire of our shared cultural survival. And this one, it's called Commons. I'll just read it. Hegemony. Hedges meet in holy matrimony. Private space marries its neighbor, eats the commoners. Urban motion collapses the gaps. Easy money, leave no agora untried. Close the garage door, arm the alarm, ignore ragpile in doorway. Hedge funds spell out on TV screen as public spaces line up for the firing squad. Ready or nauseous, capitalism is cyclical.
I was like, did you write the ha ha?
It's a good poetic moment when a poem ends in a ha.
I guess I've got this one last one I could share. Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right. Security system C. Everything that moves in the night is a danger. Naturalized. The newspapers unfortunately just report on the reality. Criminality, genetic inferiority, history apart. White settlers sink into the snow upon landing. 1 foot on this soil and they are one of us. Made natural, made one of us. We are not allowed to name. The dark secret I tie up in ribbons. Twist round a chicken bone, a wishbone of secrecy. A tiny tourniquet. If you deny it blood, it will drop off and die. Not true. The traces are gangrenous. Speak of the serrature. Lines of dark, lines of white, lines of power in the silent unnamed. 1 foot in the snow, 1 in the sand. The mark of Cain on your dark face, the mark of Cain on my light face. The silence makes my mark invisible, makes walls of stone, encampments, encroachments, enactments on the CBC with minor players wiping aprons in the kitchen, dying in the background. Dark like the earth, evincing blood, eviscerated in Faulkner fictions of light in August. August arrests, roundups in pre-dawn raids by the lake, bodies standing out in silhouette on the snow near Toronto, a white string to mark an invisible center at the scene of a body dragged into silence. Thanks.
Nice. Thank you. Thanks, Nada. Thank you very much to both of you. Okay. I've got all sorts of... questions and things knocking around in my head. One thing we've talked about a number of times, as we sort of have slid back and forth between here we are in poetry, here we are in protest, here we are back in poetry, here we are back in protest. And they've been very blurred together, which I'm very happy about, actually. But we've talked, when we've been on the protest side of that, we've talked a little bit about diversity of tactics, one of the phrases that's been kicking around Vancouver the last couple of weeks.
I thought we weren't going to get into this.
We could talk about diversity of poetic devices.
That's what I was going to say. I want to talk about diversity of poetic tactics, if we can use that phrase. One thing I might say as an immediate reaction to both of your work is that not all the things you read, but in certain poems, I'd suggest there's quite a difference where in some of your poems, Nava, there's a tendency toward a kind of a direct statement, a readability, so that the political or the content, if you will, is coming across. And I think in part the effect of that poem, especially right now, it creates solidarity. It can pump us up, bring us together, community, those sorts of things. At least that's how I read some of those poems, as aiming at that. By comparison, Cecily, I think some of the things you read were a little more what we might call disjunctive, a little more unreadable, and yet, in this kind of a fracturing and torquing of that language, there are some very powerful juxtapositions of words that bump and rub against each other, have again an incredible political resonance, I think. Look for one right now. I guess one of my favorite lines there in your Coppermine poem was people speak poetry, other batten hold up. This is a wonderful little shift. That battening is powerful. Mm-hmm. Something else I was looking for here, and I'm not finding it right now. I think that's in the first poem you read, actually. Unicorn public. I like that. You know, that's sort of the mythical fictionalness of the unicorn and compared with public. Mm-hmm. You know, we're always looking for that fictional, mythical public we'd like to imagine exists and we're perhaps a part of. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about diversity of poetic tactics.
Yeah. Well, I think it has to do with goals, first of all. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure why everybody writes. I can think about it in terms of myself. And one of the key pieces is about communication. And I think, like, it's possible, obviously, to have lots of meaning to something that you've written and are reading if people are understanding tone and they're understanding a mood and they're getting some of the imagery, regardless if they're getting everything, because I think there's hopefully levels. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, because my main practice of poetry isn't in any sort of mainstream spaces, but is often with the communities that I work with and in. And, you know, one measure is for my friends who are speaking English as a second language, I really always appreciate their feedback. So it's like, okay, does Harsha get it? And it matters to me. And the feedback that I get is that, yeah, there is always those moments that people can connect, even if they're not getting the every single line and the words together. And I think there's different, I mean, I actually don't like to think about it, anything political or poetry, whatever, in terms of tactics. It's kind of a hard and pointed moment when many of us regularly are thinking more, maybe I guess strategy is a better frame, or but it's not even that hard edge. Like, I think so much of us are just trying to get by, get along, you know, build ourselves up, build our communities up, and in struggle, and we're always in struggle. So so it's about trying to find some useful I do think about pragmatics, and I do think about the practicality of poetry. It seems sometimes very incompatible, but I don't believe that's the case. I'm kind of rambling. I don't know. I think
I wonder sometimes if they come out after the fact. Like, you might write something for whatever reason, and then look at it and go, "Hey, you know, that's it's using this kind of tactic." I'm noticing. I wasn't consciously doing that, but actually, this would fit nicely in this kind of a context because I wrote this way or because I did this.
Absolutely, and I think that's where maybe form comes in, and that's where you can, you know, can create some structure of emphasis, and again going back to that piece of communication. So it does, I do consider it, and certainly more recently when doing some collective work, there's a a group of poets, well, it was seven of us, now it's eight, and whatever, it's an open group, yeah. Who've been trying to marry the poetics and political work, and it's been quite a challenge for us, I think. Yeah. I don't want to speak on behalf of the group, but with right. it. And we've had to have some really clear efforts at trying to make something fit into a political moment. So what yeah. is it to perform at protest or perform publicly in unsanctioned areas where random moments of poetry. And part of that has to do, there is a simplifying and perhaps simplifying.
I disagree completely.
With the simplifying? Yeah, no, okay, but I'm already backtracking, because I actually, when I say simplify or simple, I actually think that's a very complimentary thing. I mean to say that it is unified. That there is that there's an effort in order to communicate, say, with eight people trying to work on a composite piece, there has to be some kind of unity to what we're doing. And so that the language, for example, this piece that we drafted as a group has a refrain, and a refrain that is almost childlike and lyrical for sure. And the tone of it is, I'm backtracking. You give me these look. Let Navi, you talk.
I like
you
your,
talk,
darling.
Your rain on, is that the refrain?
Yeah. Yeah,
no, I like your juxtaposing lyrical and childlike.
Well, these are dangerous words, but I also think childlike is not bad, and so I don't want to conflate, but please talk.
Well, I think, Steve, that divide is really useful as a construct, and I think that's what we do. We set up constructs in order to examine them, and then we tear them down. And I think I have to start with saying that what I thought you were going to say when you started to talk about this was that the divide between, for instance, the lyrical, the direct, the explicit, and the, I guess sound poetry is a category you could use, or like more esoteric, more, what was the word that you used to describe the way that Cecily put
disjunctive? Yeah, I use that word, maybe. Yeah.
Let's use that. So that divide, I think I write in both those traditions.
Sure.
And I think we both probably do. There are points where something will come out that suddenly is more lyrical, even in someone who's writing in a very disjunctive way.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about.
That's
exactly what I'm aiming at, because I think that's probably true of all of us in this room, that in certain circumstances we write in different modes.
Yeah, and I think particularly when you're, so for me, like, it teaches its own, right? But for me personally, the kind of creative work that excites me and motivates me, the reason that I wrote anything around the Olympics was because of that sense of creative work being not only in relationship with communities or with organizing or with, protests, but actually coming out of them, being like threaded through and through them. And I think that's what keeps me sane in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. Like, I play music as well. And I think that's true for all creative production. I think that, the history of creativity comes out of people's daily lives and out of the need for us to stay grounded. And here and now, I think it's a way to heal, it's a way to have strength, it's a way to keep ourselves connected to each other, it's a way to reach out of our alone spaces, just me alone with the writing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to be more transparent or more explicit.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what's needed, is being able to do that kind of wordplay. And I know different audiences are going to take it in different ways, and I know for sure that piece works best with the audience at Rhizome. And I knew that going in. And that, something that is the style that I'm more accustomed to writing in, which is going to be more more piece by piece, kind of sound by sound, word by word, is going to work better in an academic setting. But I, for me personally, in order to stay grounded and connected, I need to join those two.
They're good.
And try to make them cross each other.
Yeah. Did you?
I was just thinking about the. I'm sorry to have my back turned to you.
That's okay.
I was just thinking about the relationship of the question here around the politics, political content of writing, and sort of formal decisions that get made that bring politics into the poem. And I was actually thinking about this in relation to the last piece that Cecily read, which struck me as really interesting, because the piece formally was a kind of constructivist poem working with sort of pieces of found material, found language, culled from a specific site of struggle, and that in a way it was interesting, because the poem in sort of juxtaposition juxtaposing these fragments of language formally, in a way, kind of enacts or performs the same process that built the tent city itself, and is often with occupations.
Scraps.
Working with scraps, the sort of pieces of things that are cobbled together. So I saw that piece as a nice kind of...
Like barricade building.
Yeah, like the formal, the poem is a kind of formal correlative, a poetic correlative to a specific set of struggle, which is interesting. So the politics there are both within the utterances that are being collected, but it's also in their organization. That's something that I'm really interested in, is the questions like at what point for poets who are also involved politically as activists or as organizers in various places, how they're thinking about verbal compositions and poetic compositions and the politics of form is informed by their thinking around organization and social struggle and in resistance movements, and vice versa. So trying to think that through, that question of poetic form as partially a problem of social form, and the other way around, which is not an easy thing. It's kind of like, you know, rubbing your stomach and tapping your head at the same time to try to think them both at the same time.
Maybe I can throw this back at you guys, is that, Roger, you're uncovering some great stuff there. That my first question, I think, was really thinking those kind of terms, that poem, whatever this means, of direct statement, and that poem of disjunctive fragmentation, both strike me as very political. Maybe they're, thinking about that tired language now, that they're different tactics, but they both have a to me, a similar, well, maybe slightly different aim, but they're both in the political sphere. But anyhow, spin this back at you guys. And then here's another artificial distinction. But I might look at some of the people we've had in the booth
poet
in the last
baiting.
Week. Yeah, I'm going to poet bait here. We're activist bait, I'm not sure we should. But, a few of the people we've had in the booth, I would look at them and I'd say, neat, here's a poet who's also an activist. I might look at you two and go, oh, wow, neat, here's an activist who's also a poet. Now, I'm slightly privileging one of those terms, and I realize that's totally artificial. But I'm curious about, and I've been asking everyone that's come in here about, what role they see as poetry having in the current situation. Why are you writing poetry right now? Mm-hmm. Go ahead. If you have any response to that at all,
I do. First of all, it's just so interesting to hear you guys talk about it. I'm learning. It troubles me because I keep coming across it now in the past couple of years as I try to be an organizer, frankly, in the context of cultural production, so whether it's fields of arts or poetry or whatnot, and consistently coming across this dichotomy of activists versus artists or activists versus poets, as though these are... I mean, and also just the construction of a political sphere is also troubling for me because I don't live like that. So I think... Good.
I'm trying to erase that line.
Right. I appreciate that you're giving me something
to... I don't want that line to exist. Poet and activist or artist and activist.
And
most people I know that doesn't really exist.
Yeah, and it's just so for me, there's dangers to it, and there's also, okay, that's a relief that it's political. Mainly because I much of my life, and I think it'd be hard to uncover, and maybe this is a determined sort of feminist stance, but I can't really separate out my personal from this relationship to political, so there's that hackneyed. Mm-hmm. But I really don't, and what I do struggle with in the context of poetry is actually how to locate body and how to locate the personal without being overwhelmed by that, and overwhelmed by the critique that goes with that, and historically that I've come up against again and again, and especially as a racialized body, I would say. There's an added kind of element there that we're led down a path, and that part of that's healing, part of that's getting over stuff, but part of it's necessary. I guess I'd maybe want to pull back and go to that question about what writing poetry now and why and what is the sort of the import of that, because, as I was saying to you, Steve, I think it feels really, really necessary right now and really, really important. And I don't know to what degree that is a construct that's coming from a mainstream presence of, you know, again, the pseudo beer commercial poetry that's finding its way into you know, Olympic. Okay, I'm gonna leave that aside, but into
right.
But there's this moment, right, where it's like poetry's okay, right, and so there's that, but there's also a need to go, well, actually, not just any poetry. As we would be discerning about anything in life, we need to be very critical. And I do get confused because I'm not always sure. And I just to broaden it more widely, why are people creating? Like I'm always curious about the goals or the sort of desires behind that. I have some understanding of that for myself, and really it's rooted in a very urgent sense of struggle. You know, the context of this unceded land, which, you know. I think about and is a regular part of the days, day to day, in terms of how the folks that I know and work with in life see this moment and see this state and see this land. And it's bound up in my own sense of liberation, too. And I'm sure somebody said that better, but...
no, it's never been said better.
It sounds much better when you say it.
Okay. Yeah, all right, enough of that. Here you go. Yeah.
Well, I guess, Cecily, when you're talking about why do people write... Why are we writing right now? For me, struggling with not having had any... Being wordless for 2 months before... the first day of before the opening ceremonies. I've been playing music, I've been finding other ways, but for me there's creative expression for me, and I know it has multiple purposes. Some people write because everybody writes because they love it, but some people write because we want to, you know, have a career as a writer, which is noble. I'm fine with it, but I find that any time you're professionalizing, you're always going to make compromises. That's just part of any profession. Right, and so you have to choose where you're going to professionalize and where you're going to keep yourself free, and we all.
That's why we're here on the radio.
Yeah, and you know we all have to earn a living, and I don't. People make our own choices, and I respect that. But for me, as a writer and as a musician, let's say, or in any kind of creative production, it seems to me that humanness involves creativity, and if we're in parts of struggle are exhausting, and parts of organizing are demoralizing, and are you know it literally I guess exhausting, and I'm not even nearly as active as some other folks.
Organizing
and I like, for me personally, I keep needing to stop because I keep getting burnt out and exhausted, and I think a lot of people have that kind of experience of how you struggle with exhaustion. And for me, creative expression gives people strength, it's a source of healing, it's a source of feeling alive and human in the face of this incredible violence, devastation, overwhelming authoritative structures that you cannot resist in the face of their enormity. And so music and poetry and creative expression has always given people strength, and that's where I come from with it. Yeah. For me, and that's the way that I can't separate, you know, poetry from community, from organizing, because they're one and the same thing. They need to be one and the same thing for me, or they become distasteful to me.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I just was going to say that I think though it is challenging when we have these more dominant constructs of what is artist, what is a poet, what is an activist, an organizer, these language, such that I think there are many, many people. I certainly know many people who don't feel that they actually do. Can claim these categories or step into these spaces, and that the process of creation, creating, can turn into a very painful and bitter, isolated thing, and so I think that there's been a difference for me in recent memory. The process of the Olympics and which has been, you know, for many of us many years, has been very generative, is that the word? Mm-hmm. Of a lot of work. Like I've actually been kind of a machine about it. Mm-hmm. But that's been quite isolated, and so it's only in more recent memory that's become something that I've been able to find places to share and sort of a commonality. So I think there's two parts to it. It's not.
No, I'm agreeing. I'm saying the same thing as you. I don't know if it sounded like I wasn't.
I think exactly I'm adding to what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you're in the same. You're in the
That's
same
exactly
field.
What I'm talking about.
And, you know, I feel like I should apologize now for bringing up the characterization, but it just struck me looking over at you guys that just how deeply involved you are.
Cecily, much more than me.
Can I intervene into that binary for a minute? In the way it's framed in terms of a question we've been sort of circulating around for weeks here around poetry and politics, which is kind of a pretty blunt instrument in terms of talking about these things. But
sure,
in terms of the relationship between poets and social movements, mm-hmm. if we were to sort of try to approach the question through something, you know, theoretically through the way in which poets participate in movements. So actually, poets are actually part, like when we can't really draw them as separate sets, right? Mm-hmm. Poets are parts of social movements, like they're people who write, but then who also are within movements. And so for me, the question really comes back to compositional questions about what do poets bring to an analysis of movement discourse? Mm. What's the relationship to movement discourse? What does it mean to participate in language production from within a movement, a resistance movement, as a poet, and to think through questions of language transparency and recuperation.
That slogans have been
coming
out for us.
Yeah, recuperation, the relationship between movement discourse and the media. What kinds of slogans are filtered by the media? So these kinds of mm-hmm. questions are in a way a question of poetics that one doesn't even have to be a poet in order to understand these questions, linguistic problems of representation. But what I'm trying to say is that I think that that poetics is very much the question of poetics in the sense of consideration of language is very much a problem for movements, and so this is a point where they seem quite intimately merged. And if we're talking about poetry, I'm going to read a passage from Marx. It's only one sentence.
Keep it short, Roger.
It's one sentence, and it's from his letter to Rouge, and he writes, "Nothing prevents us from making criticism of politics, participation in politics, and therefore real struggles, the starting point of our criticism, and from identifying our criticism with them." And I think that if you just sort of replace the word poetics, if you replace criticism with the word poetics,
read it again with poetics.
Yeah, so nothing prevents us from making our poetics political, participation in politics, and therefore real struggles, the starting point of our poetics, and from identifying our poetics with them. And so this then becomes a question of where one's attention as a poet is turned. And one of my complaints, I suppose, of a lot of contemporary avant-garde writing, that innovative writing that presents itself as political, it's often very much concerned with deeply commodified language. There's a critique of the commodity and a critique of capital, and so we often tend to collect the language of consumerism, the language of marketing, and try to sort of turn it back onto the system that produces it as a kind of negative gesture. One, you know, which has been effective historically for the avant-garde, but what I'm seeing in the writing that's emerging at this particular moment right now is a turn towards language of social movements and an investigation of that material poetically.
You're right.
Which I think I think there's something not just in Vancouver. I think that we're seeing a turn right now in contemporary poetry and poetics towards movement discourse and towards languages of resistance.
Well, and I think that kind of ties back into, if we can return to what Steve opened with, which was that discussion of diversity of tactics, to use that overused expression again, that reminds me of the question of poetic creation is one piece of what people do when you're, you know, you live in your community and you support people you care about. And so, you know, on like one day, just like with the discussion of diversity tactics, where it's the same people that are, you know, on one day supporting the Women's March, and on another day supporting the Tent City, and on another day going and breaking windows. Like, those are all the same people. Mm-hmm. It's not distinct people. No, I think that's important, you know, for people to understand. And I think, and the separation between people who do different kinds of activities as though any of us is just poets is ridiculous, yeah, right? Like, one day, you know, you're cleaning up the garbage on the Tent City floor, and then the next day, and then you're playing music with people around the fire and going home stinking like smoke, and then, like, I don't like that stink. And we've been tag teaming. I've been coming home stinking of it one day, and Tom the next day, so the house is never free of smoke. But and then, you know, dealing with all of that, one way that humans deal with life is through creative expression, and so poetry comes out, and then poetry goes back into those spaces, and you get the Tent City Poetry Night, or you get the Rasm event, and so there's a diversity of poetics literally in life, and the experience of being there has been a profoundly poetic experience. Like, when I hear the found poem that you read, when I'm there, I'm hearing all these conversations and all this language swirling around me, and that is this profoundly lyrical poetic experience, even if it is sometimes disjunctive.
Yeah, it's both. But you know, I think you bring up a really critical part of that process, and it's not just the creation or the writing of poetry, however, whatever the form we're choosing, but it's the audience, right? It's also that we get that there's a desire and a part of which drives us is to give that back. And not even a gift. It's not that truly. It's way more. It's way more enjoyable and personal and personally benefiting, but it's part of the equation. There's definitely needs to be so that moment, for example, of that organized inaugural event at Tent Village. I've been calling it Tent City, but Tent Village. You know, of poetry. I think it was really, really important to note that was a group of poets that came together around that and to build. Momentum, strength, community, expression, for sure. And that's absolutely, it's a strategy for sure. I think it's really important, but I think I just wanted to add one element that I think is also very critical about poetic interventions right now, is that we do struggle with language. And those of us who don't have the privilege to, I shouldn't say those of us, those folks who may not have the privilege to be studying language, to be, you know, at a critical stance to it, to be inundated with it daily and in very authoritative ways from everything from signage to commercial to whatever, right? So it's overwhelming, and if you're at all sensitive to it, it's damaging. And so then to come from those spaces, those hard spaces and hard conditions, and to expect to be creative in the context of protest, for example, wow, I mean, I'm truly a little tired of Homes Not Games versus No Olympics and Stolen Native Land. Like, I mean, they're both absolutely critical. These are the two clear messages that will come from this moment, and one will have more success in an electoral frame, and one will continue to be an ongoing deep-seated struggle, and they're both very important, so I have to say that. But yeah, very, very tired of that repetition. It almost becomes, we must be careful, I think, of becoming, you know, the ways in which our counter-hegemonic efforts become co-opted as the function of counter-hegemonic activity. So, am I making sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. See, this is great. I get to say ignorant and provocative things. And then you guys say the wonderful stuff I wish I was saying, because it's what I actually think and believe. But, you know, I just say the stupid stuff. So that's
you
perfect.
Should speak your mind.
You know, there's been, I don't know where we are here, but this may be a bit of a tangent, but Nav, on one of your poems, you mentioned some of those cute little Olympic mascots. And I saw in the news, I think last night, that there was a, quote, protest by a group of people who want Muck Muck, apparently is the name of the character, to be an official mascot. There's a fourth mascot named, for some reason, named Muck Muck, who is not an official mascot. But he exists, and he's Olympic. I don't know what his status is.
That's where that forward went around. There was a forward Muck Muck joins the Black Bloc.
I think the Hudson's, Bay deserves another mailbox over this.
So the mainstream media last night covered this protest of maybe 10 people lobbying to have
Muck Muck be added?
Official mascot.
What is Muck Muck?
He's a little potato guy.
He's a potato?
Oh, it looks like a potato.
I'm hearing a new slogan, fuck Muck Muck.
No!
Careful.
I read that Muck Muck joined the Black Bloc, actually.
Yeah, I saw, oh, that. I saw a video photo.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the other thing is, I'm thinking, there's a tangent here. Hold on a sec. Mm-hmm. About a week ago, maybe in the second or third day of the Olympics, right after the first initial protests, another mock protest was covered by the mainstream media, and it was a group protesting the fact that you couldn't get close enough to the Olympic torch mm-hmm. to get a good photograph of it because mm-hmm. of the fencing. And both of these stories were framed as protest, as demonstration, mm-hmm. with nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So I'm fascinated by mm-hmm. how the media is taking this atmosphere and the protest, and they're spinning out these mock, humorous, parodic protests.
Well, and some of it, there is also a branch of quote-unquote protest that is about fans being able to produce their own media.
Right.
And I've seen that eat up a lot of... energy, time, money, and resources in a way that, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah. I also think, it was a great presentation that Donato did on Evening News last week and exploring some of the various elements of counter-protests that have happened.
Mm.
Interesting, definitely, to have a mainstreaming of this idea of protest and people feeling that, there's something to that, maybe positive, something
I think
it's to that. Well, of course it is, but I'm just wondering, what does that mean for you? Like, say, when I was 11, Olympics was great. I didn't know much about protests. And so, I mean, to have those two conflated and then, you know, maybe 10 years from then, I'm just saying there's something interesting in that moment, I think. But what I find fascinating is, and I'm sure many people have been commenting on the fact that the major disturbances, the kinds of aggressive, violent activity, arrest situations, etc., are overwhelmingly members of the so-called Red Bloc, but the Canadian fans. And we know at the end of the day, so the tally at the end of that, you know, is going to be decidedly heavy with that crowd. The activities were to remove the sound and perhaps, you know, not understand the text could be perceived visually quite similarly, also as a kind of protest, as a, you know, positive protest. So I find it's just there's some interesting things happening about people's public presence that's, of course, very uncritical. But I'm trying to find some positive moments here. So.
You did a good job.
I was wondering if we started on something that'd be nice to come back to, I think, about accessing spaces and accessing language. And I think that's really, that's something we've talked about a lot that really matters a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And I think you kind of brought it up and then we've skated away.
Well, there's...
I wonder is there interest in exploring that further?
Sure.
Yeah.
No.
Go for
just
it.
Kidding.
I'd like to focus on that a little more because I think that's really important.
There's a lot of elements to that idea of access. And I find that people often run screaming immediately as soon as you start talking about access. It's so social.
Because there's an assumption that the poetry writing isn't going to be as good if it's accessible.
Yeah, well, that's part of it, and also just like, yeah, we're appealing to a denominator that's common and low, and that's just insulting. That's part of it, but it's also there's a lack of complexity to the understanding that idea. And when we think about accessibility, we get caught up into discourses of disability, for example, and it's a problem. So language, I mean, beginning first of all, I had that side mention of our dominance of English language. I have outbursts in writing and also steal randomly from French-speaking moments, Spanish-speaking sort of contexts. I don't speak Spanish. I do speak French very poorly. I read it fairly well. And at times from Mohawk, too, is something else I've studied. And there's moments where those pieces of language find their way in and they're desperate, isolated moments. And I feel that, and I'm deliberate in that, because I know there's not a continuity. Part of that, the French side of it, for sure, is understanding the settler nation and trying to get at that very hegemonic. And it's funny, actually, in Vancouver, suddenly with the Olympic moment, there's French everywhere.
Yeah, right.
You know, after years of... Anyway, so...
I like your line, put your best face forward, mine,
mm-hmm,
montre ta mine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I should have got you
it's
to pronounce
play.
It. I should have got my French line.
Montrealer.
She is, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm a rural southwestern terrier. But my point in that is there's something that breaks down often when I'm feel trapped in English language.
Mm-hmm.
I have no choice. You know, that's not true. I mean, I can lifelong learning, I guess, if I had the time and space. Real quickly, I think that the other piece of it is our access to understanding language. And so that is something that people can do intuitively, but I think it's also something that people study, deeply. And
I wonder if it's less an issue of access than it is to pick up another current protest word that's been shaping things in Vancouver, convergence, rather than access in some ways. So, you know, a convergence of languages. Or I think back to the speakers just last night at Vivo's Evening News. And, you know, when you had a lawyer speak briefly at some point, you had an architect speak, but you also had someone from the Tent Village. I'm trying to remember his name, one of the organizers.
Dave Dewar, yeah.
Yeah, and you had, I'm trying to think who else, a poet speak at some point.
An NGOer, though he would loathe to be called that.
Yeah,
our job.
Right. Oh. Good job. Right, now we're getting down to
for the record.
It was just incredible, you know, you wouldn't look at that space and just go, well, this is an academic space, or nor would you go, this is an activist space, nor would you go, this is purely a cultural space. Right. There's a convergence of all those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a great deal of access. You know, a friend of mine was asking me about it, and she said, were there any people who are pro-Olympics there as well? No. Okay. I guess
diversity only needs to go so far.
Exactly.
People who have many spaces and feel people who have many spaces to speak and who feel safe in the current dominant culture don't need us to help give them more spaces to speak, because every space is a space for them to speak.
Exactly. Very good.
And we come together, and this idea of affinity, I think, is a key one there, and that goes well with convergence. And I just grow so tired of critiques of, oh, well, there's a protest, but you can't tell what they're protesting because all their signs are different. And I'm just like, that's great. This is a good moment.
That anxiety, we have to have a central message. What's the key message?
Well, that's very much, you just help me out here, but modernists or this is not understanding, a complex and complicated understanding of what needs to be.
And a kind of a desire to impose a kind of... like a universal subjectivity on a body of demonstrators, as if there's some that kind of semiotic crisis it produces. Like this, we have to have somehow this has to become coherent,
because it's a form of social discipline, and the fact that resisting coherence is already vital in and of itself.
Agreed.
I think that's really that's kind of a very hopeful. Image of not of, you know, when you speak about language, like I grew up in a house where five languages were spoken at home regularly around me, and in a city where that wasn't that unusual, or in a neighborhood where that wasn't that unusual. And I was just sitting there earlier today, and I've got this Yiddish poem here, or a song here that's about, because I'm trying to work on something around the discussions about direct action that arose on the 13th.
Get some Yiddish in here.
Because that's, you know, it's my father's mother tongue. And so I don't... I've been struggling with this language, which once you turn it into English is kind of ugly sounding. When you read the transliteration, it doesn't sound beautiful, but in the original it sounds beautiful. And it's powerful, and it's written after the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising and inspired by it by someone who was living in the Vilna Ghetto. It's a really famous song. It's called Partisan Song, and it's about, you know, these words are written in blood and not in lead, and we say these with a pistol in our hand, and it's not a happy song that the birds sing in the sky. It's a song about struggle and giving up our lives for what we believe in. And that's... You know, I was raised in a really, really conservative Zionist setting, and that was a song we grew up with. Right? And yet now the idea of defending your land against violence for people, the idea that, you know, you might break a window or something like that is suddenly so horrific. And yet all the people that I grew up with, we sang this song in the choir as children, you know. But I think it's really hopeful, coming back to that was a sidetrack, for instance, the Tent City Poetry Night, some of the poets who read at the end, who connected beautifully with that audience, were, you know, the youth and the folks from the who were like staying in the Tent Village, who were reading some of their stuff, and people who have been in that position and have left, who've gotten out of those kinds of positions, but know what it feels like. A couple of people reading there, right? And so, I guess like Mercedes and Reg and folks that are reading with like an intimate knowledge of that, what that experience means. And I think exactly what you're saying, Steve, being able to bring these voices together without needing to make them be one or be harmonious or all use the same aesthetics, and without needing to say that one is more appropriate or that, I don't know, I'm really inherently anti-elitist, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think there is a fair bit of hopefulness. And that's what one of the feelings I've been getting from these different events, this radio show maybe, but certainly the evening news, certainly the demonstrations, despite how they're being, you know, fed and spun out on the outside, for the people inside them, is incredibly, you know, and it has to do with affinity and those sorts of things, I suppose. And again, it's that moment of where that, you know, lines we might draw sometimes or in certain circumstances might be drawn between, say, you know, culture and activism are just obliterated. And you know, it's like a great moment when you look around on that first march and go, you know, oh shit, you know, there's a dozen people I can see around me who I know are all poets.
Yeah. that was a great moment.
That was beautiful.
These are the breaking down of all these boundaries, of all these limits.
Beautiful and unprecedented in my experience in Vancouver, but...
That's hopeful. Yeah.
It was very hopeful for me, too.
But it's we need some continuity, and we need and we need material, and we need structure, and we need
openness.
Process of openness and like structure.
No, we need openness. We need to pick up on what we've done here in the past few weeks with people coming out to all these different spaces and continue that openness to diversity of styles, aesthetics, and voices in the poetic communities here.
The cultural front.
Well, and I mean. I'm very interested in the what?
I said or block.
Or block.
Block.
I need not make my next comment.
For that. I'm gonna think about that.
Yeah. No, I mean it is critical, but it is well, I mean there's a theoretical context to that idea of the cultural front, but I think that I mean we constantly have to address this idea of elitism. We have to constantly address power. We're never going to escape that, and so I think that it is a good moment, and it is a unifying moment because we're all sharing a particular space with the same stakes. Not the same for everybody. People carry different risks when they step onto the streets for different reasons. But that there does need to be once you know we've kind of sifted through the euphoria and the fatigue and the exhaustion and get back to it. Like there does need to be it's real work. I think, and real time.
Yeah, you're right. Huh. I wonder, should we play a song here and take a breather and see, come back and see if we've got a little bit more or if we've just got some final words to say after a song?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's play a song. Come on, iPod. okay, carrying on, we opened with Johnny Depp reading some William Blake, so I'm going to carry on with music that features poetry or poets, and this one we'll dedicate to the folks at the Tent City. This is one of the real drags about not having, this is one of the points where you really wish you had a terrestrial radio signal. I was just thinking how great it would be if we could actually be beaming. We could be heard in the Tent City, and we could actually
the
have.
Bannock didn't want that. They did not want that at all.
No, so we can be heard in Athens.
Radio bar.
We can be heard in Athens. We can be heard in Venezuela, but we
Barcelona.
Can't. Yeah, but we can't be heard in Tent City. Anyhow, we'll play this song. This is The Clash, "Ghetto Defendant" with Allen Ginsberg.
Starved in Metropolis, hooked on Necropolis, addict of Metropolis. Do the worm on Acropolis, slam dance Cosmopolis, enlighten the populace. Girl.
like its end.
Not in eternity. Serenity.
Ghetto defender, it's his heroin pity. Not tear gas, no baton jar, that's not to take in the city.
Strung out committee.
Walled out of the city, cloud down from uptown. Spray pest from the nest, run out to Barrio Town.
The guards are itchy.
At the feast, men sweep up the night, flipped pieces of coin,
broken bottles,
exchange for birthright,
drafted in a jiffy.
Ghetto defender, it is heroin pity.
Strung out committee.
Not tear gas, no baton jar, we'll stop you taking the city.
Not sitting pretty.
Prince of Gala Poets was bounced out of the room.
Young not to ramble.
By the bodyguards of greed for disturbing the tomb.
1873.
His words like flamethrowers.
Paris Commune.
Burnt the ghettos in their chests. His face painted whiter than he was laid to rest.
Died in Marseille. Buried in Charlie.
It is heroin pity. Not tear gas, no baton jar. Stop you taking the city.
Shut up in eternity.
It is heroin pity. Not tear gas, no baton jar. Stop you taking the city.
Guatemala, Honduras, Poland, 100 years war. TV rerun invasion, death squad Salvador, Afghanistan meditation, old Chinese flu, kick junk, what else can a poor worker do?
Actually, just coming back to say a few thank yous and goodbyes. We've had, have we done four shows, Roger, in the last?
This is our fourth show.
Or so? We've done four shows here at Short Range Poetic Device. Our hope is to perhaps continue this as a monthly event. So stay tuned, as they say.
And I want to give a big shout out to the folks at Vivo. This place has just been so central in providing a space and all these different forums, and to Alex and Brian in particular, who have been bearing and for providing a safe and supportive environment for me to work out my DJ fantasies, which has been really nice.
Yeah.
And just in terms of providing an autonomous media space, given that the Olympics is such a media is so much a part of the Olympics is as a media spectacle. I was thinking in a lot of ways that the Olympics is actually experienced primarily as a TV event.
Even if when you're living here.
Yeah, because most people can't afford to go, and so they actually encounter the Olympics as crowds, but also as a television event. And so the sort of overcoming and a hijacking of media space by the Olympics, which we've seen here at Vivo with the new Industry Canada VANOC communications police that shut down our transmitter. These autonomous media spaces are just absolutely central, and people at Vivo are really big round of applause for Vivo. Yay.
Well said, Rogers. Thanks, Vivo. Thanks, Alex and Brian. And thank you to our guests tonight, Cecily Nicholson and Navis Malesh, and all our guests last week and future guests who may come along.
Thanks for having
thanks,
us.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks to you, Steve and Roger, for having us. This is fantastic.
Yeah, it's lovely.
And what are you sending us off into the sunset with, Roger?
I'm going to play something here, if I can find it. Let's see here. Yeah, well, just thinking, following up on this question of autonomous media spaces and the Olympics as a TV spectacle. We'll close with Gil Scott-Heron's "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised."
Nice.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Detroit from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message.